First case on our calendar, 04193, Francisco Sarmiento versus Grange Mutual Insurance Company. Ms. Johnson.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Brenda Johnson, and I'm here on behalf of certain members of the Sarmiento and Camacho families, all of whom are related, so I'm just going to refer to them as the Sarmientos for ease of reference. In any event, the Sarmientos, who are all residents of Ohio, were traveling one fine day in 1998 in Portales, New Mexico, when they were involved in an accident caused by an uninsured driver. They were traveling at the time in a car that was principally garaged and registered in the state of Ohio and covered by a policy of insurance issued by Grange Mutual. In New Mexico, tort claims are subject to a 3-year statute of limitations. And this presents the first issue that we're presented with here on our appeal, which we submit this court has already resolved in Miller versus Progressive Mutual back in 1994, which is this: can an uninsured motorist insurer issue a policy and enforce a policy provision that purports to limit the time in which an insured can bring a claim for uninsured motorist coverage to a period less than that the insured would be entitled to pursue the underlying tort claim? The only twist presented in our case is this. In Miller, the accident that was at issue was one that occurred in the state of Ohio, where tort claims are subject to a 2-year statute of limitations. And the factual holding, therefore, in Miller was that a 2-year policy limitation would be reasonable. And that language has been relied on by various courts, including the 8th District, to support the proposition that a 2-year statute of limitations, 2-year contractual limitation is per se reasonable regardless of whether the underlying tort claim is subject to a different statute of limitations. We maintain that the reasoning that this court came to in Miller is actually controlling and really actually dictates what the 8th District should have done in this case, which is to hold that in the situation where the tort claim has a longer statute of limitations, it is contrary to the governing version of 3937.18 to enforce a contract provision that would give the insureds less time in which to pursue their claim under the policy.
We've had a long history in the last several years of very clearly delineating in cases the difference between tort claims for which the coverage is provided and UMC claims for which it is a contract action. And we've had given a lot of rights to the plaintiffs based on contract actions that are contravailing what they could have gotten under a tort. For example, a longer, 15-year right to sue under the contract action for contract provisions. Why should we deviate from that principle now and start mixing up the tort and the contract provisions when we've had some pretty clear lines drawn under Ohio law?
Actually, our position is not inconsistent with the lines that this court has drawn in opinions subsequent to Miller, such as Current and Kasulik, where the court has said, yes, there is a difference between the tort claim and the contract claim, but 3937.18 requires certain coverage to be provided to people who are injured in certain tort claims. And in order to determine whether the contract is actually providing the type of coverage that was mandated under the UM statute, it is sometimes necessary to look to the underlying tort action to determine whether the proper coverage has been provided. And that's exactly what this court did in Current. And in that case, to the, I suppose the arguable practical detriment of the plaintiff, because in that case, the plaintiff had argued that Michigan's tort law, really, which was a no-fault law and provided that the plaintiff couldn't recover anything under Michigan tort law, shouldn't really govern, that the policy should nonetheless step in and provide some coverage for that particular insured in this court, I think not at all inconsistently with any of its other decisions, said, no, you have to look to the underlying tort claim to determine whether there's something here for which the contract coverage should step in. Our position here is no different. Our position is simply this, though, that when you look to the underlying tort claim in light of the rationale and interpretation of 3937, that's set, 0.18 that's set forth in Miller, you have to look to see how long the court, the underlying tort law would have given that person to make a tort claim in order to determine whether the coverage that's mandated by under the applicable version of the statute, and I'm sure the court is aware, remembers this, but we are dealing with the former version of the statute, whether the coverage mandated by that, which as this court said in Miller, is supposed to be coverage that places the insured in the position they would have been in had the tortfeasor been covered with some insurance. You have to look to that. Now, I apologize. I should have mentioned that I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time. Anyway, there is also a cross appeal presented in this case, and that has to do with a separate but somewhat related issue, which is whether the tolling provisions of 2305.16 preclude the enforcement of a contractual statute limitation period against minors under an insurance policy, and I would argue under any other contract. The defendants, the insurance company in this case has argued that enforcing 2305.16 in cases such as ours would lead to various rather terrible things. They claim that it would essentially allow minor insureds to selectively disaffirm contract terms, which we maintain is a little bit of an overstatement. We are simply saying that under the tolling provisions set forth in 2305.16, a minor insured has until he or she reaches minority to enforce his rights under the contract. All other contract terms would remain in place, and there's really no basis in law or really logic for the proposition that applying the tolling provision in this case would somehow or other allow a minor to disaffirm other contract provisions. The other arguments that Grange has made are that 2305.16 does not by its terms apply to written contractual limitations, which we submit is a rather too nice reading of the statute. The statute, by its own terms, applies specifically to contract claims, whether or not they have contractual limitations in them, and should apply in this instance.
Does our decision in Weaver versus Edwin Shaw Hospital have any bearing on this? Are they two separate issues?
No, it has quite a bit of bearing on this, actually. We believe that it dispenses with an entire branch of Grange's arguments. They made quite a bit of a point of arguing that for some reason a minor's disability should be considered lifted if that minor or somebody on the minor's behalf has engaged an attorney. And we believe that that entire direction of their argument has been effectively dealt with by this court in Weaver, where this court has said specifically that 2305.16 must be read by and interpreted by its very terms, and it is specific as to what constitutes a lifting of disability. And the only lifting of disability applicable to minors is reaching the age of majority. It doesn't involve retaining anybody else to represent them or whether they have a guardian who is acting on their behalf.
C- Counsel, you say in your brief that your client made a timely notification or prompt notification of the claim to the insurance company. What does that mean?
That means that very shortly after the accident, Grange was put on notice of a potential claim, and that there were attempts made well before this suit was brought, the suit from which this appeal was brought, to attempt to resolve the claims.
And at what point did it become clear that there was not going to be adequate insurance coverage or any insurance coverage by the tortfeasor?
That investigation was conducted in part through counsel in New Mexico, so I'm not entirely privy to those specific facts. I can say, however, that Grange's subrogation rights have been fully protected in this instance because suit has been brought against the tortfeasor, was brought in a timely fashion under New Mexico law, and is still pending. So to that extent, Grange's practical interest in protection, both with respect to notice and subrogation, are fully protected in this
instance. Since that's still pending, the exposure of Grange, if there wasn't this argument about 2-year versus 3-year statute of limitations, the exposure of Grange is not actually capable of being determined yet.
This is very possible, yes. I mean, it seems settled at this point that there is no insurance available through the tortfeasor. However, arguably, yeah, there could, I suppose, be assets available. Although I'm not entirely sure how that would work in a UM context. But yeah, there are issues that remain to be resolved with respect to that. You're correct. And I would like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may, unless there are other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Fitzgerald.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. As to the issues on the cross appeal, Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. Thank you. I am pleased to be here this morning representing Grange Mutual Casualty Company to urge the court to affirm the 8th District decision relating to the enforceability of the 2-year policy limitation period, and to also, as to the cross appeal, reverse the 8th District Court of Appeals as to the issue relating to the enforceability of that provision to the two minors as a result of its application of the tolling statute in 2305. 0.16.
Counsel, could you work out for us the practical problem that I'm seeing here that I got to in my last question, and that is accident occurs in a state that has a 3-year statute of limitations for bringing the cause of action. It's brought not within 2, but within 3. Your company is on notice early on that there may be exposure, but the degree of the exposure would not be determined until the tortfeasor may have assets or may have some insurance. There's a dispute about the degree of the injury, what's the dollar amount that ought to be assigned, and it can't be resolved between the tortfeasor and the plaintiffs, so they go to trial. Wouldn't it be true in those fact patterns that the exposure of the UM and the underinsured coverage wouldn't be known until the underlying lawsuit is resolved? In other words, your company knows they may or may not have exposure. There may or may not be enough coverage out there to cover the claim. To take the position that you're advocating, wouldn't your policyholders have to just file suit against the company within 2 years in order to protect themselves if we give the outcome that the 8th District gave?
Well, in this case, the issue and the claim was presented as an uninsured motorist claim. In that scenario, it was known that the tortfeasor was uninsured, not whether there was going to be sufficient liability coverage, but that there was no liability coverage. So the insured would be on notice upon discovery of that fact that there was no liability coverage, and there would need to be a UM claim presented at that point in time.
But not till you turn the defendant upside down and shake their pockets out. Do you know the degree of that?
Well, the provision in the Grange policy, I believe, takes into account the scenario that you may be presenting, which is not presented here, which is that it's a 2-year term from the date of the accident, or 1 year from the date when it's known that the claim is available, whichever is later. So in the scenario and the hypothetical that you're—
So that's the second part of that paragraph would cover that situation.
It conceivably could. It doesn't apply here, but in the scenario that you're presenting, it could conceivably apply.
Well, yeah, you could read it that way, but you could read it another way too, couldn't you?
Which the Grange provision?
Yeah, you could read it that it simply means that they knew of the accident or knew of the injury. It's a discovery kind of thing.
Well, the way the provision reads is it's aware of a claim. So and I think that is designed to take into account the concerns that have led to cases like where the liability insurer becomes insolvent. And that may not happen until years after the accident. And therefore, a UM, an uninsured motorist claim, would not arise until the liability insurer became insolvent. And this provision allows for insurance to have that additional year upon the realization that there is no liability insurance to present that claim more than 2 years after the automobile accident.
Do you agree that the plaintiffs did notify your client within the 2-year statute of limitations that there was a potential claim?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So from the standpoint of protecting your interests, that was done in a timely fashion, but essentially you want them to be in a position where they have to sue you before they have to sue the tortfeasor.
Well, the problem with that analogy is—
Well, I mean, isn't that the bottom line?
The bottom line is that this court has said that a 2-year period is reasonable for requiring insurance.
So if they were to do it right here, they had to sue you before they had to sue the tortfeasor, a year before.
Within the term of this scenario, within 1 year before, they would have had to have sued the tortfeasor.
But you don't, suing the tortfeasor, I mean, your UM responsibility doesn't diminish because the tortfeasor has any assets to collect, does it? I mean, you have a standalone contract that only depends on whether they're insured or not. Is that not correct?
That is correct.
So the asset issue of whether they have any deep pocket or assets to go after strictly goes toward ability to subrogate.
A subrogation interest.
But you don't get any diminished responsibility on UM payout if they, you know, own a nice house.
If they're a millionaire or if they're penniless, it does not determine the obligations under the uninsured motorist coverage provided by the policy. That's correct, Justice.
And
Stratton,
if you had a recalcitrant tortfeasor that didn't want to cooperate under a 2-year statute of limitations with a 2-year UM coverage limitation, you could have the same fix where you'd have to file against both before you really knew what you had with the tortfeasor. You know, that's no different. I mean, you could have that same issue in both cases.
Well, I think, again, as I was discussing with Justice Pfeiffer, the terms of this insurance policy take into account just such a scenario, that if the insured finds out more than 2 years after the accident, either because the tortfeasor can't be found or is in some way unwilling to disclose what liability insurance coverage is available, Once it is found out that there is a claim that can be made under the Grange policy, the insured has a year after that to file the lawsuit or the request for arbitration. So it takes into account those scenarios that seem to be of your concern. So I don't think that it in any way impairs the insured's ability to protect their own rights, and at the same time, it recognizes the rights of Grange to confine the time frame in which claims can in fact be made, which is the real goal for not just the contractual limitation period, but any statute of limitations, is to cut off stale claims.
Let's take another scenario. You have a 2-year period to make the claim against you for UM. The investigation reveals no insurance. And so you then make your payment, you pay your claim. And then they still have a year in which to sue the tortfeasor. So if they haven't sued the tortfeasor before you pay them, they don't have any obligation to file that suit yet, do they? Because they haven't destroyed any subrogation rights yet, have they?
If Grange would be obligated to protect its own subrogation rights as well. If Grange were to make a payment to the insured under the belief that the tortfeasor was uninsured, and wanted to try to recover that payment from the tortfeasor, then it would be Grange's obligation to follow through and proceed against the tortfeasor.
So once you make your UM payment to your insured, then the burden falls on you then, as long as you've still got a year?
There would be an assignment of the insured's rights against the tortfeasor to the uninsured motorist carrier to pursue the tortfeasor to protect its own rights at that point in time. This case presents the an example of just how these types of provisions in insurance policies would be rendered null and void if you have to look at the specific statutes of limitations that apply to the tort claims where the accident occurred. As we set forth in our brief, the statutes of limitations in the states across the country vary from anywhere from 1 year up to 6 years. So in order, for example, if an individual is traveling in Detroit, Michigan, Michigan has a 3-year statute of limitations, just like New Mexico does, as does New York. If someone is traveling in Buffalo, New York, and gets in an automobile accident, that would be a 3-year statute of limitations that would apply. However, if the statute of limitations happens to be 6 years, which it is in Maine and North Dakota, that insured would be treated differently. There would be no way for the insurance company or the insured to predict when it is that they needed to file their lawsuit if it's determined that it is the tort statute of limitations that applies and not the express language that's found in the insurance policy. And that was of concern to this court.
Oh, but your company lives with that dilemma all the time. Your company insures tortfeasors as well as folks who are the victim of tortfeasors. So, you know, if you're insured is driving in Maine and causes an accident, it's their fault. Your company lives with the 6-year statute of limitations. That's the price of doing business.
As to the liability provision,
right. They're not unfamiliar with how to handle cases like that and keep the file alive and the facts alive and all of those things. It doesn't seem that those different years would be that burdensome in terms of handling the uninsured and underinsured claims.
Except for the fact that this court has said that limitations that appear in uninsured motorist policies like this can be enforceable, and that is what insurance companies have relied upon in terms of drafting their insurance policies, is this court's pronouncement that those types of limitations will be enforced in Ohio. And there's been no suggestion in this case that limitation provisions in insurance policies should be declared null and void completely. The only argument is that given the application in this case, the appellants feel that it unduly restricts their ability to sue because the New Mexico statute happens to be 3 years. But this court in Lane versus Grange recognized the very concerns that I was speaking of a moment ago, that if you have to look to the various states in terms of when you file your lawsuit for UM coverage, it's creating the very uncertainty and unpredictability that these statutes or these limitation periods are designed to to provide for. So
Counsel, could we turn to that second issue regarding the minors? Because you do talk about the Miller case, and you've cited it in your brief. Did the Miller case squarely address the issue of the tolling of the statute with respect to the minor child there?
No, it did not, but I would agree. I think, Justice Stratton, you asked about the Weaver case. I think the Weaver case does provide some instruction here, because in Weaver, this court said that disability statutes, and it was a very disability statute that we're talking about here, is to be strictly construed, and that it should be limited only to the specific language in the statute. The statute of the disability statute here does not talk about contract limitation provisions, and given the fact that it was a contract provision that's applicable here, we would submit that the disability statute does not apply. Moreover, this court has said that the disability statute relating to minors does not apply in circumstances where the time limit is a conditioned precedent to being able to bring that cause of action. The examples are wrongful death and workers' compensation statutes, where this court has said that the disability statute, even though the beneficiary may be a minor, does not apply. We would submit that this is a conditioned precedent in the UM policy at issue, and just like
wrongful death would be markedly different, because all of the claims are required to be gathered together by the personal representative of the estate, regardless of the ages and.
That is true, Justice Pfeiffer.
That really isn't a good comparison, is it?
Well, but it is, I believe, for the reason that the minor is just as much at a disadvantage when he or she has a wrongful death claim to pursue, and he's unable to do so. This court has said that
but they're never able to do so. When a minor turns 18, they still can't bring the wrongful death action. It can only be brought by the personal representative of the estate.
But that is not true in the scenario of workers' comp, where this court has also said.
Well, I'm just challenging you on the wrongful
but
death comparison.
The rationale for the disability statute is that it's because the minor is unable to bring the claim, as he cannot do in a wrongful death case. The minor is to be given the benefit of being able to wait until they turn 18. It's no different than in a wrongful death case, where the minor is still unable to bring that claim. And Mr. Chief Justice, I see that I'm out of time. May I just briefly conclude at this point?
You may, but you're going to take your time for rebuttal. I was going to give you 30 seconds.
Very good. I'll reserve that time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Ms. Johnson, you've saved about 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the issues just addressed, I'm going to deal with things a little backwards. On the issues just addressed having to do with the tolling statute, the principles and policy issues behind the tolling statute are actually not at issue here. It's the actual language of the statute. And the language of the statute quite simply does not include either workers' compensation or wrongful death claims. Therefore, regardless of whether it might possibly be a good idea, and I suppose I might think it was, to include them within the ambit of the tolling statute, they simply are not included in it, and therefore any kind of argument based on the fact that minors' claims under those two statutory regimens are treated differently really doesn't matter here. As to the issue of minors being permitted somehow to people contracting on minors' behalf being permitted to contract away the protections of the disability statute, the tolling statute, I maintain that it would basically render the statute a nullity. If you could simply contract away the protections, if I, acting on behalf of a minor, could simply contract away those protections would essentially be meaningless. With respect to the other issues raised on our appeal, this court's made a very good point. Forcing insureds to bring suit before the tort issues are resolved is not necessary to protect the insurer and serves no reasonable purpose that they may have.
But you can have that exact same fact pattern under a two-year match, that you can't have the tort issues resolved. You file your suit against the tortfeasor on the last day of the 2 years, and you file your suit against the UM carrier on the last day of the 2 years, and neither are resolved. I mean, there's no difference.
Very true. But as this court pointed out in Miller, if you give a shorter period for the insurer to essentially have to go sue their insurance company, you're depriving them, in essence, of the coverage that was mandated under the statute in the first place. The whole purpose of the statute, as this court recognized in Miller, was to attempt to put the insured in the same position he or she would have been in had there been insurance, and giving the insured less time in which to pursue their insurance company than they would in order to pursue the tortfeasor, and to be made whole if the tortfeasor had some kind of insurance, defeats the purposes of the policy behind the statute. With respect to the issue of varying statutes somehow or other making things difficult, I submit, and I think this court's already recognized, that insurance companies deal with different tort statutes of limitations all the time and are required to interpret their policies in light of those all the time. This doesn't present any particularly different difficulty for them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Fitzgerald, you use your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, the point Ms. Johnson just made, that the wrongful death and the workers' comp statutes aren't expressly set forth in the disability tolling statute is precisely our point. Nor is there any provision in the disability statute that talks about contractual limitations periods. If the General Assembly had intended that a minor's claim under all scenarios would be told during minority, the statute would have expressly said that. It doesn't do that, and we would submit that it should be strictly construed just as to those statutes of limitations that are set forth in the disability statute itself. Finally, the test set forth in Miller is one of reasonableness. It's not one that requires any other inquiry, and this court said expressly that two-year statutes or two-year periods of time to bring UM claims are exactly what would satisfy that reasonableness standard. And for that reason, we would submit that the two-year statute in the Grange policy should be enforced as the 8th District did, and we would ask that the court affirm that decision, and we would ask that the court reverse the decision of the 8th District as to the disability or the application of the disability statute. Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.